Welcome to Clinical Conversations 114th podcast. It comes to you from Journal Watch, whose website is at jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. It's March 1st, 2011. I'm on the line with Dr. Danielle Scherer of Physicians First Watch and the Medical University of South Carolina. This time, we interview Dr. Lori Mosca, who chaired the writing committee that recently issued updated guidelines for the prevention of cardiovascular disease in women. They're available in circulation. Dr. Mosca is Director of Preventive Cardiology at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Associate Professor of Medicine at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and the founder and director of the Columbia Center for Heart Disease Prevention, all in New York City. Welcome, Dr. Mosca.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You've changed the title of your recommendation slightly from evidence-based guidelines to effectiveness-based guidelines. What's behind that shift?
The change in our title really reflects a paradigm shift in the way that we're approaching the guidelines. It's well recognized by most clinicians in practice that when we see interventions that have been tested in the clinical trial setting, when we apply those in the real world, the results often fall short of what we see in clinical trials. And in this particular set of guidelines, we wanted to combine both what we learned from the systematic scientific review of the evidence and also clinical experience. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, these are a softer, kinder guideline.
Oh, I see. So, and along those lines, the 2007 update introduced these three levels of cardiovascular risk, so high risk, at risk, and optimal risk. So briefly, could you remind us what those, why those categories expanded?
Well, we changed the categorization just slightly. We still have a high risk classification, an at risk classification, and instead of an optimal risk category, we call it ideal cardiovascular health, which really expands our concept of including women who have healthy lifestyles as well as optimal risk factors for heart disease. Now, our other two categories have changed a little bit. Our high-risk category now includes a little bit of a lowering of the threshold for what we would consider high-risk. In previous guidelines, the 10-year predicted Framingham risk for coronary heart disease, and that's for death due to coronary heart disease or myocardial infarction, that level was defined as greater or equal to 20%. What we've done now is we've changed that level to greater or equal to 10% of cardiovascular disease risk. Mm-hmm. Now, we've done this for a couple of reasons. Number one, the standard tools that we have that measure and predict. This is really a prediction tool that predict risk in women tend to underestimate that risk in women. So where the Framingham function, it might work quite well in men, for women, it tends to underestimate to a greater degree. So that's one reason. The other reason is women tend to have more stroke relative to MI compared to men. So because women experience a greater proportion of their cardiovascular outcomes as stroke, we wanted to make sure we had this expanded outcome. And I want to be really clear on this point. Some individuals may confuse this with the fact that, we're expanding the number of women being treated. Not so at all. Mm-hmm. These categories are for prognostication. These categories do not determine any of the preventive interventions. The high-risk category is a very mixed group. When we give recommendations for aspirin, for example, we base them on whether or not a woman has existing coronary heart disease, diabetes, etc. The guidelines for lipids are still based on the 10-year projected coronary heart disease risk. Mm-hmm. So that change in lowering the threshold for what we consider high risk has no consequences really for pharmacotherapy recommendations. What we do hope is that it will help physicians encourage women to engage in more aggressive lifestyle behaviors because they are higher risk than we have considered them in the past. Now, the other change that has been made is the at-risk category. What we've done here is we've actually expanded these to include two conditions that have not previously been on there. One is the inflammatory conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis, systemic lupus. Mm-hmm. These conditions are associated with inflammation, and inflammation has been associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. The other thing that we have done is add pregnancy complications. And I think this is a very important change because many physicians don't have it on their radar screen that pregnancy complications can be associated with an increased future risk of cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. So specifically, preeclampsia, for example, may actually double the risk of stroke in the next 10 to 15 years for a woman. Gestational diabetes, bleeding in the third trimester, all of these conditions have been associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. And we really want doctors to begin to routinely ask these questions when they do their medical intakes. And also, we think it's a great opportunity when women access the healthcare system because they are pregnant. If these conditions happen, this is a great opportunity to begin the dialogue about cardiovascular disease prevention.
It is interesting and sort of popped out at me when I was reading them is, you know, utilizing these natural inflection points in a woman's life where she's very likely to interface with medical system, such as menarche, pregnancy, and menopause, which you're right. I don't, you know, currently, especially with menarche and pregnancy, it has not traditionally been on the radar of treating physicians, whether they're OB-GYN or primary care doctors, to have a discussion about cardiovascular risk.
Oh, absolutely, and it's a real missed opportunity in practice. I really hope that by raising awareness and adding this to our list of risk factors, that this will really encourage healthcare providers to not only ask about it, but to also really begin to help women take action, you know, when the pregnancy is completed and they can get back into an exercise program and hopefully be more motivated to adopt those heart healthy lifestyle habits that we encourage in all women.
There are a lot of recommendations here. Unfortunately, many of them, such as smoking cessation, weight reduction, and exercise, for example, I mean, a lot of these things really should be built into preventive counseling for a lot of primary care doctors. But as you also cite in your article, you know, primary care doctors cite a lot of barriers to implementing these preventive strategies, such as lack of time or lack of organizational support or patient resistance to these changes. So having said that, do you have any advice for these really busy primary care physicians on some kind of a staged approach to this screening? So, for example, do some of these rise above others in importance, or should they start with class one, or should they start with recommendations that they think the patient's more likely to adopt quickly or easily?
Sure, great question. You know, this sort of hierarchical approach has been suggested in the past, but I want to point out a couple things that I think everybody should know and be encouraged about. First of all of our lifestyle interventions are class one. That means they're all equally important in the expert panel's eyes. However, this issue about barriers is very important, but I do want to encourage physicians that the simple act of asking women about their lifestyle habits has been associated with improvements in those. And I suggest, and you know, I've had a preventive cardiology practice for 2 decades now, each and every encounter, every patient fills out a sheet about how much physical activity they're getting, what their diet is like, are they smoking. The simple act of asking these questions has been associated with improvements, and these research studies have been published. So I don't want doctors to be discouraged, you know, that they're not going to have an impact because these things take so much time. I think the key here is to build into your clinics the infrastructure which makes this easy. So when patients come back, have a simple form to ask them about their lifestyle behaviors or have the triage nurse or your assistant ask about this. Where there are problems, you can have targeted conversations with your patients that are brief that may impact. But importantly, you should also have handy a list of referrals. I do believe most physicians would agree, you know, smoking cessation, for example, is probably one of the most challenging things that we face in clinical practice, and it's not enough just to give pharmacotherapy and advice. I mean, many of these patients need to be referred to formal behavioral programs, and we need to know where those are. So I do think that even though there are barriers, we should not be discouraged that whatever effort we put into it, I want people to know that we are going to make a difference. And not only for heart disease prevention, these lifestyle behaviors are critical for cancer control, osteoporosis, so many conditions that are important to women.
Dr. Mosca, I was interested in your colleagues' reaction so far to the advice that they consider a complicated pregnancy or other indicators of inflammation as risk factors. Has there been, have you had much reaction to that?
Yeah, I think the reaction has been terrific to add in the pregnancy complications. I think it's been a real teachable moment for a lot of healthcare providers. Where I have gotten some feedback, and I think this is because there's some confusion around this high risk category. I think there's some concern that by lowering the threshold for what we consider high risk, that there's going to be this massive overtreatment of women. And that's absolutely not the case. You know, we've gotten to the place where each and every preventive recommendation that we make, you know, aside from the lifestyle, which is recommended for all women, each and every one of those interventions has a specific subpopulation of women that is based on the evidence. Mm-hmm. And again, this is because high risk is very heterogeneous. And at-risk is very heterogeneous. You know, so we're not making blanket recommendations based on the bucket that you fall into. And I think it's very important that, that healthcare providers understand that there is somewhat of a disconnect between that risk classification and the actual clinical recommendations. And this is because we're staying very true to the evidence base. You know, we don't want to make a class one recommendation for a pot of women that has not yet even been studied in clinical trials. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we don't want women who, you know, if I had a 1 in 10 chance in the next 10 years of having a major cardiovascular event, I would certainly consider myself high risk. You know, so I do think that these in some ways are arbitrary. The eyes of the beholder, what do you consider high risk? That's a separate issue from the actual clinical recommendations, which are based on who's been studied in which trials. Mm-hmm.
And the other recommendation that was interesting is the recommendation to screen women for depression when they turn up at high risk for cardiovascular disease. What was the rationale on that?
Yeah, great. That's such a great point, and is one that we had extensive dialogue about on the expert panel. You may know that in our previous guidelines, depression screening was on our list. It made the list of items that we formally, systematically searched and made recommendations about. The challenge with depression is that treatment of depression and screening for depression has not been associated directly with improved clinical outcomes. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to stay, again, true to the evidence. We wanted to list those things, you know, which have been studied and have some positive evidence for improvement in clinical outcomes. However, the panel felt so strongly that depression is a critically important condition in women. It's prevalent. It's under-recognized. But most importantly, there was a very good argument made that depression has been linked to non-adherence. Mm-hmm. And depression has been linked to adverse lifestyle choices. So we wanted to encourage doctors to, again, put depression on your radar screen. Consider it as something you want to evaluate in the context of how is this impacting adherence to the other evidence-based recommendations. But we did not want to mislead our audience that screening for depression or treating depression has been associated with improved clinical outcomes, because it has not.
I have one last question for you, Dr. Mosca. If you could have clinicians do one thing different this week, say, than they were doing last week, in screening women for cardiovascular disease, what would you want them to do?
Well, unfortunately, I think that most physicians don't screen for lifestyle behaviors and psychosocial risk factors. Mm-hmm. And pregnancy histories. I really think that if physicians just built into their practice a more systematic approach to assessing these risk factors, it will go such a long way in reducing the burden of cardiovascular disease in women. You know, we're not going to make major, major headway if we just approach this with pharmacotherapy. If you look at the decline in the death rate due to coronary heart disease over the last two decades, 50% of it is explained by control of major risk factors, blood pressure, cholesterol, and not smoke, and decrease in smoking rates. These three things are all associated with lifestyle behaviors. And lifestyle behaviors are going to be the most cost-effective approach we have to this epidemic. And I really, really want to encourage physicians to talk to their women about lifestyle and really begin to address the barriers that women have to leading a heart-healthy lifestyle. So, because I think this is really, you know, it may not be new and sexy, but it's going to be the best way and best approach that we have to reduce this burden.
Well, that's great advice, Dr. Mosca. We want to thank you for spending time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's it for Conversation 114. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Ador Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. For myself and Dr. Danielle Scherer, thank you for listening.